This episode is brought to you by Harrah's Resort SoCal. Nestled against a rolling hillside and just down the road from Palomar Mountain, guests at Harrah's Resort SoCal can expect gorgeous views, friendly staff, available night and day to encourage everyone to have a great time. When I was there recently, I had a chance to dine at California's first and the nation's largest Hell's Kitchen. And it's true, the beef Wellington and sticky toffee dessert are great. The restaurant is inspired by the hit TV show and features a menu approved by the Michelin star celebrity chef, Gordon Ramsay himself. Hope to see you all at Harrah's Resort SoCal in 2024. Today I have my brother, Tom Nguyen. He was my episode one, and 2 years later, we are basically here with at the end of my second year, going into my third year. And I'm bringing my brother back on. He's a lecturer at RMIT in the design department, as well as an owner of a VFX company, a big VFX company in Vietnam. And they do most work for studios around the world, predominantly in the US.
Welcome to The Vietnamese. I'm your host, Kenneth Nguyen. Being part of a culture of nearly 100 million Vietnamese people in the world today comes with a lot of pain, proud history, and privilege. Join me as I highlight and explore the Vietnamese experience from all over the world.
So welcome, Tom. Welcome back.
Hello. Nice to be back.
So the reason I wanted to bring you back on is because I know that you have always followed this idea of, futurism and artificial intelligence and the whole movement of things going towards singularity. And you know, it's all mumbo jumbo to me sometimes, but I try to follow what you talk about and try to figure out the things that you say. But I want to bring you today to kind of make sense to us lay people about the effects of, what we're seeing, you know, specifically Lenza or Stable Diffusion and all of these things that we're seeing on our Facebook feeds and our Instagram feeds. And we're going to go into a deep, deep dive. And your background with all this stuff is, you know, utilizing AI because it really is affecting, or it's going to affect your business in a very bottom line way in the next few years. So you've been ahead of this curve now for a few years. So that's why we're here. We're going to talk about how this is going to affect Vietnam, how it affects your business, and how it affects just overall our life in general.
Okay.
Wonderful. So can we talk about, firstly, your animation business and how it's going to be directly affected by AI in the next few years?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, it's the VFX business. So I have actually three businesses under Vietnamation. It's the VFX, it's a toy manufacturing business, and now a game company. So three companies. And they're all going to equally be affected in one way or another. The VFX, I think it's going to be the most impacted one. I think in about 5 years, 95% of the work that we're doing now is going to be taken over by AI. So we have to learn to either find out what the AI can do to help speed the work up, or find a new pockets of work that AI can be applied to. Because right now we're doing a lot of, say, like background replacements, right? Right now you see text to image that they can generate any kind of background, right? And they're working on models of text to video. So a no-brainer is in 2, 3, 4 years, there's going to be high resolution text to video, right? And in compositing and bringing all those things together for visual effects. So that's going to be pretty much, a lot of it's going to be wiped away. So that's that. So I'm finding out ways in which pockets are still hard that AI can affect the VFX business. The toy manufacturing, I think, is probably the most safe business. That involves a lot of hand work. The 3D modeling part is probably going to be taken over by AI too, because I can see a lot of 3D model topology being done. It's at its earliest stages, but pretty soon you're going to be able to say, give me a figure with like a cat head or something, and it will generate hundreds of different models, and you can choose the right topology or features, and you can mismatch, you know, by voice command. So the design part is going to be greatly assisted by the AI. But the manufacturing part, once we 3D print it and start to make it into a silicone mold and into the clay mold and plaster and pouring the liquid mold, that I hope AI can't do in the next 10, 15 years, and still, and you know, until they start having fingers controlled by AI, because it's delicate work. So that's, I think, safe for the next 10, 15 years. But the design part of the toy company is not, right? For the toy comp for the game company, like backgrounds, we're already using it to generate backgrounds for our games. Also, game assets, you know, like weapons or effects and stuff like that. We start with the generations of AIs to start us off, or give us ideation. So it's saving us a lot of time on ideation now, right? Before, an artist would take about 10 days to come up with maybe 3 to 5 designs for characters and sketch them out and present it. Now we can just type in a bunch of stuff and within one night have about a couple thousand different options or ideations. So yeah, concept design is going to be greatly shortened with that.
You have about close to 200 employees in Vietnam working in the VFX games, toys under your wing. Now, how much of Vietnam do you think is aware of this sort of AI revolution at your level? The bosses, the guys that are having these businesses of VFX, are they making concessions? Are they trying to figure out what the next step is?
I think every single one of I, you know, I'm friends with a lot of you know, people in the industry, graphics, VFX, animation, and I see them posting stuff, you know, or in groups, because I'm part of like 20 different Facebook groups of AI art and AI generation related stuff, and I see them here and there lurking. So they're all aware of it, I'm pretty sure. It's just a matter of us scrambling how to make best use of it now, you know. So I've managed to find a couple of places I'm pretty sure they are. I also have a lot of students who are interning maybe at these ad agencies, and they're using it for their ad work too, for commercials and you know, promotions and things like that.
It's already here. The
Yeah,
stuff's already here.
yeah. Yeah.
And what about, I think that you kind of answered that, but let me just ask you directly, what are you doing to mitigate directly, the consequences of AI? Like, what are you doing in place?
Yeah, it's not about mitigating either, right? I mean, I don't know how you define the word mitigate, but it's more about how do you bring it into the fold and start to use it. Implementation is more the mindset that I have rather than mitigate, I guess,
Yeah,
if that
so
makes any
you're not
sense.
afraid of it. You're gonna,
None.
yeah, you're
Yeah, I
taking the
actually the
bull by the
opposite.
horns.
I'm loving it and I'm anticipating every new release. Any new features that come out, any research teams that are on the side adding to the next release of these AI models, I'm all about that. So, and it because it helps you predict what can be done. You know, usually when you see a research group releasing papers, you can expect 6 months or to a year it will be available to everyone to use. Yeah.
Yeah, it's so different because people who are not into technology like me, we live in fear. I live in fear. When I see AI, when I see
Of course.
anything remotely re replacing jobs and security for people in Vietnam or people in the US, around the world, laborers, employment, I get freaked out. But I think that, people who are involved in technology like you are go headfirst into designing the next phases of your business and putting technology at the forefront to kind of mitigate, the changes in a in when AI is coming.
Yeah. And I really don't know how to explain that, you know, like why some people are geared more towards that or not, you know. I think maybe you need like some kind of gateway service, right? Like really simple stuff where you pay 10 bucks a month and it does, you know, just very simple stuff. I think so, you know, people like you could greatly benefit by tippy toeing. The stuff that I'm doing requires like, you know, Python and installation, PyTorch, all these libraries and stuff. So it's a higher learning curve, and I can see where if you're not inclined to that, it would scare you. But I would suggest for people who are scared of AI, put in the 10 bucks for these really easy to use entry level stuff, and it will do amazing things.
Like Lenza. You see it all over Facebook feeds and IG feeds now.
That's what I, you know, that's I'm not too familiar with Lens. I know a little bit about it. It's like some kind of enhancing image that uses AI.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's a good example of very simple, basic entry level stuff that you know, that you can learn to get to use on your side to help you.
Yeah, it's like dipping your toes into it.
Yeah.
Now, you've taken a deep dive into to the AI world and the art world for a while now. Do you think that there's a direct path to monetize any of the sort of like the art stuff out there?
I think so. A lot of people goes there isn't, or it's already been done, or we have stand no chance. But I'm constantly reminded, like I'm in a group of like an AI art where there's like, I think 250,000 people in there, right? But there's only about constantly maybe about maybe 100 people posting, or everyone else is just there to watch, or you know. So the amount of people who are going forward with this is, the ratio is very tiny or small. So yeah, it's definitely right now room for blue ocean, if you can think of things.
Yeah. Well, why do you think out of 250,000 people, there's only like 100 people that post? Is it because people are just kind of like doing it, but they're kind of scared to post and show their work?
Yeah. So I think if you have like a couple hundred people posting, then you probably have another 5,000 people who are doing it, but not to the level of confidence and showing off. Yeah. You have your silly people posting stuff, right? They don't care. But I would probably be pretty confident to say that at least the other 100 to 150,000 people are not doing it at all and just there to watch. I know personally about 10-15 students who are there to watch the art but not produce anything or not even using it, you know.
So. Got it. Now, can we talk about I know you said you don't know much about Lenza because I think you're more in the other Stable Diffusion and stuff like that, but can you sort of break down, because I think a lot of us have been using Lenza and sort of, it's a basic, you know, dipping your toes in sort of platform to change your image. But can you tell me about the other ones in your world, in the, you know, art interface world that you're manipulating all of these, so we can get into the legal side of it, the fair use side, copyright side of it. But let's talk about what this is first. At the very basic entry levels, the Lenzas of the world, and then Stable Diffusion. You've mentioned other ones, but can we kind of get into all of this, because it does pertain to sort of like the art world and taking images from other people and stuff like that?
Sure. So about a year ago, DALL-E came out, right? And it was a text to image, but it had a very low coherence, right? Coherence is what you type in versus what it understands, and we call that the coherency. Very low. And if you look back at it, it's almost laughable because you can barely make out what it wants, you know. So the big example was the avocado chair. And then they, you know, released DALL-E 2 and Mid Journey came out roughly at the same time. And what they were able to do is get these models and what they call fine tuning it or retraining it. So they're getting this model and then putting a layer of extras, retraining it or telling them, hey, the next time you see a face, perfect this part, or a style, perfect this part. And if I type in this word, focus in on making that part better of this big model, right? So Midjourney is the a paid service on Discord, and they are doing a really good job at doing these fine-tuned models with special words, right? So you get like these really artsy images, but after a while, when you create these, a lot of the artistic style starts to look the same, right? And this was about 4-6 months ago. And then Stable Diffusion came out, which is one of those, but it's mainly raw. They didn't really train it, but there was no level layer on top of it, and it came out. But the beauty about that was it was open to everyone, so the community was able to train it. And so within a short amount of time, including people like me, you're like, oh, this is something raw, but we can train it. How exciting. You can bring it to your own computer and it's free. And if you don't have no internet, the whole library is about 4 gigs, all compressed. You can train it and do its give it specialized styles and things like that. So that's the thing that I've really been into, and it's much more powerful. So you can think of Midjourney.
Can I stop you real quick? You said there's 4 gigs that is on your computer, right? And this is four gigs of just like imagery across the internet.
It was language, once
programming
it
language.
It was once imagery, and then they get that information and they get concepts out of that information and they put it into little dots and matrix three-dimensional forms of, and those combination of dots in three-dimensional space can represent a concept, and it's no longer the image. So if you get like 10,000 images of cats, it all gets compressed down to a couple thousand or whatever dots in 3D space, and that can able to regenerate the concept of a cat.
Okay, so then that all is happening on your computer, right?
Yeah.
And then does it, so it's learning, it's getting trained by you, the user, but does it ever go back out to the internet and like gets trained, like a bigger brain is getting trained out in the bigger universe, or is it just
it's a snapshot of like 5 billion images. You know, I think the newer models are they're adding more images to it.
Okay, so they're live, yeah, like around the world, like it's learning.
So DALL-E 2 and Midjourney's is still connected to their servers. It's online. You need it because they charge for it, right? But Stable Diffusion, since it's open source and free, you can download it to your inner your machine and have it. So that's the difference between.
And it's always going to be this compressed 4 gig information, or is it like every month you're doing like it's 5 gig now, and then
it
becomes
So every time I train it or add it to another one, it's getting that 4 gigs and it's doing a specialized one. Like if I want to train my face and make me a Jedi or a half animal, I have that model, but it's pruned down to only 2 gigabytes. So now that specialized training model is only about 2 gigabytes of like say me, and I can add in multiple concepts of that. I could put in a Tom, a Ken, you know, a special cartoon dog, and have these different concepts and mix it together on 2 gigs.
Got it. Makes sense. Yeah. All right, and I cut you off. You were talking about
The Midjourney. Okay, so the difference between the DALL-E, Midjourney, and Stable Diffusion are the three leading ones. And this is just my observation, but I think DALL-E 2 is really good at coherence and photoreal. So if you want something to look real or understand your prompt, I think DALL-E 2 is the choice for you. That's a paid service. I think the more expensive one. The second one is Midjourney. If you're more into the artistic style, but you're not very technical, and you just want to type in a couple of words but get beautiful images, then Midjourney is for you because they spend a lot of the time on the backside doing those presets for you, right? And then the third one is Stable Diffusion, which has it comes in really raw. If you just type in stuff, it looks really plain, but it allows you to do your own presets, right? So that's where that one has a higher learning curve, but it's much more powerful if you're willing to tinker with it. So those are the three different differentiations. So I like Stable Diffusion because I can tinker it. I have it on my own computer and it's free, and I can generate thousands of images every night without extra cost.
Now, for us lay people out here, and we're looking at different artists sort of complain about copyright, fair use, and all of this business of infringing on other people's creative works. What's your take on all of this? Is it theft that these AIs are doing? Is it fair that we all are one day going to be able to capitalize on other people's stylistic sort of renderings? What's your take on all this?
Yeah, so this is very controversial. You know, like this is just like politics. There's two sides and they're so polarized right now, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm in the camp of if you take other people's references and you learn from it and you synthesize, the key word here is synthesize your new style, then that's not theft, right? Now you can argue, is taking the pictures as a training set to learn from it, is that theft? But what's the difference between you visually seeing something and then recording it into your brain and then drawing it out? You're still getting information, right? One is through flesh, right? And biological recording and output. The other one's digital. You're still getting other people's work. It's recording it in digital and it's outputting in digital. So either both of them are theft or both of them aren't. Yeah, it's just a different way of doing it through flesh and blood or through The digital way.
Yeah. It's all about synthesizing that sort of is, that's what we're talking about here.
Well, yeah, what's existing, and you're getting a bunch of concepts and images, and what's existing, you put it together, you synthesize it, you add in your own experience, your own wishes, your own storytelling, your own vision, whatever it is, you inject that part in with it, and you come up with something new. So I think art from the beginning of time to now has always been done that way, right? If you raise someone in a pitch black room all their life, how much art can they really produce?
Right.
So
it's just, it's a matter of references and synthesizing. But if you took Iron Man and you just ripped off that image, whether it's through these softwares or through your brain, and you just kind of render it and you, then that's going to be infringement. But
yeah. But most people who are posting Iron Man stuff, it's really out of parody and comedy, and they're not trying to make money off of it, at least on the mini groups that I'm in, right? And then, but there's other people who are truly trying to make their own unique creations, you know? And they're so far removed from how you can't accuse them of cheating or stealing at all, right? It's so far removed from what's existing out there. Because of the multiple synthesis.
If you go to these Comic Cons, right? Like you and I have gone to Comic Con, and we've seen like in the basement levels where they sell like fan art.
It's
the same thing. And why are they getting the chance to sell their fan art?
Yeah. It's multiple. Yeah. I think extracting concepts and then synthesizing it's everywhere, right? To whatever degree, right? I think the reason why you're getting backlash here is because it's just 10,000 times more efficient and faster, right? And so it feels like stealing. You hear that phrase, right? Oh, this is so good, it feels like stealing, right? Yeah. I think that's what's happening right now, you know. But when you look at the step-by-step process, it's the same thing as everyone's been doing this whole time.
So it's not it's really the same thing that's happening, you know, in the last 50 years with fan art that's being sold at Comic-Cons.
Sure, yeah.
Right? But now that everybody's able to do it, and everybody, there's like this sort of like this this blowout of possibilities that everybody now can kind of do the same art, but just even lay people, and maybe the creators of these very specialized images perhaps are going to lose out on money.
Yeah. That's another interesting question about because, you know, there's a famous artist who's pissed off that his name is used in almost everything, right? You know, the Greg guy, I can't remember his last name, Witowski or something. But everyone is using him, and he's really pissed. And so the Stable Diffusion 2.0, they left his name out, right? So if you type in the name, you can't get his style back, right? So I wonder how he's feeling about that now, right? All the, in version 1.5 and, you know, his name was everywhere, and he was famous. A lot of people knew about him, like 100 times more people knew about him, right? And then he complained. And now the new model came out, and he's nowhere to be found, right? Yeah. So I wonder how he feels about that now, right? Yeah, that's an interesting question, you know?
Wow. That is pretty interesting. It's sort of like if you are this big artist, and you're like, you know, I don't want to be on Spotify. So you lose this huge, or Apple Music or Spotify, you lose this huge chunk of listeners, even though your stuff is free, you lose these huge populations of people. Yeah. And then like now you want to go tour, or you want to sell merch, you know, you've already lost that massive sort of the bodies that would consume your stuff.
Yeah. And, you know, it's hard to say whether I feel for him or not, right? I'm not in his shoes. But it must be a roller coaster ride one day you wake up and hundreds of thousands of people are using your name to get their AI art in your style. And then the next day, no one can use it. Yeah. Right. Like that's such an interesting feeling to be experiencing.
Yeah. I mean, And another thing is, like, if you had that notoriety, don't you think people are starting to knock on your door for your original work?
That's another interesting. I wish I had the data on that, right? I wonder how many calls he was getting a month before and then how many calls he was getting after, and then maybe a year from now, how many calls he's getting, right? So you can see what kind of influence it had. Did it help him or not, right? You know, but definitely I think name recognition, he blew up, you know.
Yeah, because now your artwork is worth a lot more, you know, and it's free flowing out there in the traffic world of in the internet, and it's just like flying all over the place, and people are getting to know who you are, and they're like, oh my God, it's like an NFT, like series one through 10. You just want the original artwork now, even though there's so much copy out there.
And interestingly, what I noticed is there's so many other artists that was being used, but no one else was complaining, right? So I'm wondering, are they secretly happy, right? Like, oh man, you know, this is like good brand recognition.
Yeah.
I don't know. I've even seen a couple of like really low level artists, like it's probably, dude, when you type in my name, it understands my art, you know, and they were really happy and proud of it. So I've seen those in groups, right? You know, so I don't know. It's
such an interesting time and landscape. You know, the future is here, and talking about it, it's just mind blowing. Now there's another big thing beyond the art that you send me links all the time, which is ChatGPT.
Yeah.
What is ChatGPT, and why is it so scary? Well, scary to me, but you know.
Well, it's a language model, right? Like, and it's striving towards natural language. Like, its goal is when you talk to it, natural language understands, and it gives you back natural language. So in every iteration, it's getting better and better and better. And the last one we saw, it's pretty close, right? It still fails at some certain things, right? If you get specifically about tell me a joke about something, sometimes it fails. But it's for general conversation and knowledge, it's really close.
Well, what I was going to ask you, what is the difference? Okay, what is ChatGPT, like its main function? And then what is the difference between that as a search engine and Google?
I think Google was made off of existing links and references, right? I could be totally wrong, but this is my rudimentary interest, my basic understanding of it is Google is an algorithm. Maybe they're using AI more now, but its premise was how many people are using links to it and referring to links. And it was based its worth off of that, right? The GPT series 1, 2, 3, 3.5, 4 is just scraping everything on the internet.
I got it.
Wikipedia, PubMed, just everything that it can get its hands on. Tutorials.
I get it now. So you type in anything in search, Google search, and links pop up. It just populates your shit with a bunch of links. But ChatGPT is actually synthesizing the information in those links and building actual sort of sentences and conversations that you have as you're typing in the real words.
And you got to wonder, why didn't Google start to do this, right? They got the money. They have all,
It's a no-brainer.
Yeah, maybe they are behind closed doors and we don't know about it, you know. But it's pretty crazy. But I know Google's excelling in other parts too, you know, of AI. Their text to video is so far, it's getting there along with Meta, right? Facebook. They're in other areas. I haven't seen OpenAI do any text to video. So I think they all are going in different areas. It will all converge into one. I think I've seen interviews by Emad and Sam Altman, right? Emad's the CEO of Stability AI. And then Sam is the CEO of OpenAI. They both give a timeline of 5 years, right? And in this 5 years, Emad wants to build an AI where it will generate real world level design, like a video game, like Ready Player One, right? So he firmly believes that that's going to happen in 5 years. And then Sam Altman believes that anything that you can do in a computer right now, in 5 years, the AI will be able to do it better than humans. So when you have those two guys who are confident that this is going to happen, and you can see the exponential curve of it happening, right? within a year, the last 6 months, you can see that exponential curve just really starting to curve off like that. So in 5 years, yeah, easily anything you can do on a computer, the AI will do better.
Okay, so what are the jobs or the work that's protected, or not protected, but will basically relatively be unscathed to all of this AI transformation?
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Yeah, well, obviously, I think all the blue collar workers. Okay, it used to be where people thought the white collar was safe and the blue collar through automation or whatever, robotics. But it's now the reverse. All the white collar is getting wiped out first, and it's slowly to the blue collar. So, like having a restaurant, you know, farming, handicrafts, manufacturing, but with the hand, you know, the heavy duty manufacturing, right? Not the robotics manufacturing. I think those are the last to go, or the safest from AI first, right? And then the next thing I think is when you get one level up, which I think is when it's the artistic endeavors digitally, humans will be more the remaining ones that are still left in the game, and I hope to be part of this, is the will be more about curators rather than creators, right? I think there will be a portion of us who will add in stuff, continually train the AI so it's updated. If there's new human experiences that's happening, they will inject it in. And then the other half will be the curators, who we get that new database or whatever that's there, and curate the current experiences which we think that what the people like or what they want, and we'll be like the in-between selection process of what the AI gives us and what the population wants, and be able to bring that into a collection. I think that's most likely will happen.
God, there's very few people on, you know, if you really think about the ratio of the population of human beings, there's a handful of people who's doing the curation process for any field, right?
Yeah.
Sliver, not even 1% of anybody in any field during the curatorial process. And it's like basically mankind's labor initiatives are wiped out.
Yeah. It's going to change so much that it's going to take a lot of people off guard, you know? Like right now, I think it's taking a lot of artists off guard right now, right?
Yeah. And I think that a year ago, artists were like, oh, you know, we're going to be fine. Yeah. Writers were like, oh, we're going to be fine.
Now
you see scripts that are written in the form of, you know, you type in, was it you who brought in the South Park thing?
Yeah, you say, give me an episode of South Park, and then you give it like a couple of
prompts.
And you don't even need to give it ideas. It can come up with its own themes or subject if you don't give it. But if you do give it, it will come up with a script that matches the whole series. It's insane, right? So in the future, you might have a concept of a TV series or whatever, episode series, a web series, whatever, where you have like a core concept of words that you want your episode to be. And then it will give you, spit out 10, 20 scripts a day. And you just read it and you're like, oh, I like that one. And then you go into production. I think that's the future of screenwriting, right? So you will be the selector of what the AI gives out, and you will decide, would this be relevant to civilization? You know, so that's what,
humans in writing rooms in TV are doing that now. That's what they're doing.
Yeah. Sitting on so this will, board. Yeah. So this will speed it up, you know? if you see some current subject that's popular right now, you can say, hey, give me a little script based off all you know, the characters, you know, the behavior of each person, you know, what the sitcom tends to, the tone of it, everything. You already know that. But here is a hot topic. Give me 10 scripts about this hot topic. And then you just read it and decide which one you want to go into production.
Or you just mine for the gold that way.
Yeah.
Go, I want that, I want that, I want that. And just pull out the different setups. It's amazing. Let's go back to ChatGPT. What are some of the practical applications of this? Is it called a software, an app? What do we call it? A platform?
It's the brain of a software, right? You use a software to interface with it, like a web page or whatever, right? It's you could see it as a digital brain of some sort, you know, the database, I guess. It's hard to define that.
And how do you find it? You just type in ChatGPT on Google and it'll lead you to a prompt, a search window? Or how does it work?
Yeah, they right now for the 3.5, they have the beta, I guess, window right now. So it's open to the public. You can type in whatever you want and it will give you results. Yeah. You know, so, you know, I don't know how much longer it's going to be in beta. I think they're testing it out right now to see how it is. So you see this with OpenAI, but eventually it's going to be an API or a service, you know, where you pay a month, right? But I think it was like 10, 20, 30 bucks. A lot of people are willing to pay for it just because of the sheer amount of time that you can save, right? But that's something where I would recommend people who want to get their feet wet, right? I don't know how much the service will be, but I think it's usually somewhere between $10 and $50 a month, right? But that's not like having your own assistant, right? Instead of paying, you know, $3,000 to $5,000 or whatever dollars for your assistant, it's under 50 bucks a month, you know. I think it will be under. I'm not sure what they're going to charge, but somewhere around there.
Amazing. You sent me a video and it talked about, you know, there was the guy moderating punched in some, you know, some amazing prompts, and you just gets a detailed breakdown of medical procedures, yada, yada, yada. There's just different examples of what he did. Oh, programming of code. These are things that would have take people months to do a few years ago. And now it's like a click of a button and, you know, it materializes.
Yeah. Definitely programmers will have a hard time in the future, right? People like in the like VFX will have a hard time. And like I said, anything that you can do on a computer, you know, you better start thinking about how to become a curator, right? Or something in the traditional sense of using your hands and your body.
But in the future, even the, you know, you talked about farming and you talked about restaurant work, all of those things are being... They're being
automated
to high heaven right now. It's just all being.
Yeah. Well, I think there's one, and this is, again, my opinion, but I think there's one thing where people will maybe prefer humans is the experience, right? Like if you talk about like a fine dining experience, right?
You can't,
Some people, I mean, you might be okay with robots that can walk that kind of looks like humans who serve you, but other people would just really love like humans to serve them, right? Food and talk to them, and you know, just having humans around there, I think people won't get sick of that anytime soon. So, you know,
I mean,
we're talking about the very last bastion of of service of human relevance.
But even fine dining chefs, I mean, you can't get that automated. There's no way because
it's
The dishes taste different from day to day with different produce, with different menus. You know, those things change in fine dining restaurants weekly sometimes, you know?
So you got to think, if you want to really, really be safe, you know, you got to start to think about those human interaction jobs. Like, I mean, even podcasting, right? Like what you're doing. I think that's safe, right? Because people still want to see human perspectives on other things. Right. So that's going to be safe for a while.
Yeah. Thank God for a while until you have an algorithm or something that's aggregating the curation.
Yeah. It's
putting together, you know, I mean, if you think about it, like if you type in, like, I want to know about Tom Wynn's thinking in the future, like 5 years from now, what if some AI deepfake thing, it could put together its own podcast?
Dude, I gotta show you this video. There's a video of a guy there's an existing AI company that has about 60 different avatars of real humans, right? What they do is they film a couple minutes of you, or like 15 minutes of you, your gestures and everything, So they're able to digitize all your mannerisms, right? As a library, and you could pay like $1,000 a year to have your avatar. That guy combined that with the new GPT-3 model and made it talk. So he was just conversating with that AI model, and it just looked like he was conversating with like a semi-stiff human. But it was pretty convincing. I think in another year, it will be very fluid and cheaper, you know? So that's coming. That's coming. If you're able to maybe record about 10, 15 minutes of conversation with someone, you can get their mannerisms, what words they tend to use, and the AI will be able to synthesize that and create.
Because I can imagine like in 5 years, they'll just take all of my podcast episodes and then they'll just extract how I talk, the rhythm that I talk in, how smart or intelligent, how like it can really track how much knowledge I really know. And it'll just start to build its own sort of profile avatar of me.
Yeah.
And then you could just kind of like sit anybody in place of the guests, and that Kenneth Wynn avatar will start doing its own interview.
Yeah. All you need right now, I think there's some AI models that I saw. All you need is about, 10, 20 seconds of your audio, and it's able to reproduce your audio. And then if you have like an hour of audio, it's able to reproduce the words you tend to use, your temperament, all these other things. It's pretty crazy. Yeah, it's coming. So
even podcasters might not even be spared, right? If you think about it.
Well, it depends.
Because am I going to really be able to create a better version of me? Or am I going to be able to perform better than the algorithm or the sort of the AI version of me? Because the AI version of me has gotten all of the good parts of me in the last, let's say 10 years by that point. And it's just now going to do its own thing.
I think there's a certain attraction to watching human on human mess up, give imperfect answers, stutter, right? Yeah. I was watching this, I can't remember where, but when a human cheats playing chess using an AI, the moves are so perfect, right? And it's able to do moves that can calculate 10, 20 moves ahead. Yeah. And at first, it doesn't make sense, right? Whereas the humans, there's when they have high stakes and they're risk adverse, people love watching that part. You know, it makes it more interesting rather than this pure mechanical where everything's going to be all right or to a certain conclusion. It's like a blood sports, right? Arena. You want to see humans screw up, and that's part of the beauty of it, I think,
I think that's why MMA or sports like basketball or football will never go away, because that human sort of the fumbling and the fuck ups and all of free throw shots or missed goalie shot, will always drive the human emotion to another place.
Yeah. You said it. It's the chance of them fucking up that makes it exciting. Yeah.
So though, maybe in the future, there's going to be more of that. There'll be more things that spring up that kind of showcase.
But what if the AI can simulate fuck ups? I don't know.
No, the human psyche wouldn't treat it well, because you're just like, oh, that's just a calculated fuck up. That's not like a real fuck up. And then, if robots are playing basketball, how much of that really is fucking up? It's really calculated moves. And, is it fun to watch, a video game of people just, machines just going at it? I don't know.
Yeah, part of, I think what makes a sports team or a basketball team exciting is because each of those guys have different genetic makeup. They came from a different background. They have different ethics, practicing ethics, right? All these different things, right, comes together, and you see this bunch of imperfection trying to be perfect. Whereas the AI, it's all perfect, and it's like, where's the fun in that? Unless you can simulate all five of those AI basketball players to be imperfect in a different way, right? I don't know. That would be interesting too, but I don't think there's any fun in that, because the other imperfections from a human took 20, 30 years for it to happen, right? For whereas the AI, it can simulate imperfection instantly, and I don't know if there's any fun in that.
Where do you think humankind in 5 years will be with the labor markets, UBI, universal basic income, all of these models that are going to really just rip apart the workforce?
It's funny because I listen to a lot of futurists, transhumanists, all
Podcast.
these tech enthusiasts, right? Almost all of them say that in the future, humans are supposed to do leisurely things, right? Or creative things. Everything else is going to be automated. And in theory, I've heard things tossed around where we're only supposed to work like 3 to 5 hours a week to maintain our quality of life, because everything else will be so efficient and automated, right? So I think that sounds about right, but then the question is, who's going to stand in the way and prevent that or slow it down, right? I mean, I'm not in about conspiracy theorists. I think everything is going to eventually work out where the mass majority of people will benefit, right? But it's just a matter of how long we get there and how many greedy or stingy people are standing in the way to
Okay,
slow it
wait.
down.
But all right, let's get down to even another different point of greedy and stingy. What about this whole idea of, like, let's just say our bodies, biologically, we need to have resistance training, whether it's walking or, our bones don't grow if you're in space because there's no resistance to gravitational force and it doesn't create this sort of like this growth and or make it stronger, right? And so I think, like, I always talk about this, without any adversity, without any challenges to the human psyche, we're gonna be like that. What is it in Wall-E, that everybody's like
Fat.
fat and on conveyor belts?
I think it's not going to be that bad. I think there's always going to be a percentage of people who let themselves go, 10, 20% of the population, maybe 30%. But I think there's always the other, on the flip side, the other 20, 30% who will always introduce adversity, right? To make it more challenging and have the experience more fun, right? To appreciate the experiences, there's always going to be both sides. I don't think the whole society is going to go to shits like that, and you see it right now, right? No matter how convenient things are, like automobiles, trains, you still have people walking and running, right? There's always going to be that percentage of people who want to introduce that challenge to themselves for whatever reason.
Yeah,
So,
that's true. But you have to be very aware of it. And typically, I think you have to really kick yourself in the butt to do the walking, to eat the foods that are not prepackaged and convenient.
But when you look around, surprisingly, that number of people who are going that way is getting bigger and bigger and bigger, right? Whether it be because of education, influencers on social media saying that that's the healthy thing to do. For whatever reason it is, I see that there's a growing number of people who are headed that way, who are not being slobs,
Yeah. Now, as an educator, for the last 15 years, you've been lecturing at the design department at RMIT, which is a big university in Saigon. You've been there for 15 years. How do you think AI will eventually change the education model in Vietnam and across the world?
So it's pretty crazy. I see it in three different phases right now. When I first started, the teacher was like a god, right? This is 15 in 2005 when YouTube didn't have a lot of tutorials, or just the student depended on you for experience and knowledge and to guide them the right way, right? So that was like the first stage. And yeah, and then I think we're in the second stage, where it's the era of YouTube, right? Where it's a mix. There are students who come to class and like, oh, okay, so that's the gist of the topic. I can always go home and look it up more if I need to. I can zone out now. I can do social media. I can do other things. I can think of other things, right? So the teachers' lectures have less weight because they always know they can go to YouTube as long as they have the rough general direction. So that's where we're in right now. But I think in the future, man, I want to say the only reason why a teacher would be relevant is students want to go, I want to see what a real human, how they behave, right? How funny the guy is, or or his mannerisms. I want to, that I think, mainly what it is. But when it comes to knowledge, dude, I see it right now. Students are spacing out because knowledge comes so easily, right? We're doing the first couple of weeks, the students are, all right, I get where he's going with this course. I know what's important. I saw the syllabus. All right, I'll just attend less often and do the assignments, right? So you have to be really persistent in trying to add value in every class for students. Otherwise, I know that they're just sitting there like just daydreaming and going, like this mofo ain't giving me nothing new that I can get on the YouTube, Yeah, it's
But I think also the job of it today, not like in 3 years from now, just today, I think when I think of when my mind runs free and I think of what educators do today for students, young students, is sort of piece together the gaps, right? Like they just kind of bring everything together. Because I'm thinking about a young noodle worker
Yeah.
in the Delta, right? Or somebody working in the Midwest. They're
Yeah.
not sitting having this aggregation of knowledge and different connecting points brought together by an instructor.
Sure. But let me tell you, okay. So let me tell you what, for people who just listening to what I just said, they're like, nah, that can't be right. But let me give you a counterexample. So for instance, when I teach a course in game design, right? There's a lot of besides the software, we're not going to say that because that's obviously you can find a lot of tutorials on how to use the software. But the theoretical frameworks, right? Like game balance, right? Or game mechanics, game aesthetics, those different parts, game pillar, just a lot of these, like there's like 100 to 200 different aspects of game design that you can learn theoretically, right? So as a teacher, as a lecturer, I have to learn all of that stuff and be ready to answer the students when they ask it, right? But there's like a channel like the GDC, right? The Game Development Conference on YouTube. If they watch all of those videos, which are
Better
like an hour
business.
to 2 hours long, dude, that's like way more information than I can ever give the students. And it's all theoretical. It's everything. It's advice on how to run a company, a game company, all aspects, right? They have hundreds of videos. How can a teacher compete against that type of knowledge? So yeah, it's and I think AI will even amplify that even more, So it's going to be tricky how to be relevant as a teacher in 5 to 10 years. I don't think we stand a chance, but
If you are part of the government body in Vietnam or the US right now, what kind of policy changes would you implement?
Jesus, I don't know if there's any policy changes that you can implement because it's a pretty free society here, and they can, it's not like when you say policy, I think of something that's being restrictive, and nothing's in that sense in AI. But I think what they can do is more about funding, right? Like Imad from Stability AI, I think he had like a $10 million fund that he started off with, and he only used $600,000, I think, to train Stable Diffusion, right? So we all know the Vietnamese government, 600,000 is nothing to them, right? I think if they threw that kind of money, 10 million, into training these AIs and in a Vietnamese model language maybe, and actively teaching, helping the citizens on how to use it, right? In maybe finance, in art, in agriculture, so that all of these different industries have an AI to help them.
Wow.
I think that would be awesome,
Game
right? But
changer.
and so cheap to
Cheap
do,
to
you
do.
know? Yeah. But unfortunately, I don't. Yeah, that will lag for a while before that catches on.
But hopefully
Maybe
there's.
they're doing. Yeah, maybe they're doing it, and I don't know, right? But I haven't seen any initiative or anything like that,
Yeah, hopefully if guys like Pho Pham is listening to this, Pho, you could start to talk in the ear of some of these guys to kind of move this along. Yeah, right? I mean, you're like you said, the investment's so cheap. This is something that they should start thinking about. I don't know if we're gonna ever catch up to the K-pop or the K-dramas or the entertainment field, but this is one area we can really.
Dude, just imagine if an AI was trained on all Vietnamese stories, right? And then it was trained on all the American sitcoms, and an AI was able to synthesize those two and give you Vietnamese scripts. How much better would Vietnamese content be, right? And I think that whole endeavor would only cost a couple million dollars to train the AI,
Right, right, right.
Oh man, that was such a powerful thing to uplift Vietnamese content.
Yeah, it's a really good point. Really good point. Who are some of your, you talked about a few guys in the last hour, but who are some of the big thinkers that you follow in the field of AI? Can you kind of throw out some names and be like, you know, this is what they're all about?
Well, I think Imad, I can never remember his last name, because if you mess up his last name, it kind of sounds kind of racist. let me type him up here. Imad. Imad Mostak, rather. Mm-hmm. Imad. Yeah, just type in Imad Stability AI. Follow him on Twitter. But he's always talking about the future of what AI can do for society, right? I really love his ideas, because what in one of his talks, he talked about, you know how we have image, text to image, all compressed in 4 gigabytes? He thinks that you could do a vast amount of knowledge, like science, Wikipedia, all these different knowledge-based websites. You can all compress it to about 2 gigs, he thinks. Well, he knows. And they're working on making it a 2 gig file, so that you can access all of mankind's like knowledge on it. And so his goal is to put it on every cell phone in poor countries' kids. So it's like, we don't need the internet, essentially, right? If you want to give them access to basic knowledge, it could be on 2 gigabytes, you know. So it's thinkers like him that I absolutely look up to for future thought. He's one of them. I think Sam Altman is another one. He's the CEO of Stability AI. His talks definitely always talk about the future of what's going to happen. You know, so I get a lot of insight from him. Yeah, and then obviously all of Lex Fridman's podcast. He has a lot of AI guests on there. You know, so I pick up a lot from him.
Yeah, Lex Fridman's podcasts are dense, but they're totally digestible. You know, as a layperson, he makes it very simple to understand. Lex Fridman is what a gift to humanity.
I probably watched over 20 videos just about AI just on his podcast alone, you know. And they're all insightful.
Now, what do you think of AI itself? You know, people are sometimes afraid of, you know, the evilness of it on its own eventually. You know, it's sort of do we need to reframe this question by asking if the problem of evil is dependent on its own inherent characteristics, or is it like sort of the powers of our control, the powers in our control?
Okay, I think so. I see it as two forks, right? Think of it as, what if the AI was able to become fully sentient with arms and legs, right? I think the earliest we can have that is at least 20 years away, right? It has to be after 2035, 2040, at least, right? Where that can happen.
Why? Why at least 2035, 2040? Why do you
think? Well, I'm the firm believer in what you mentioned earlier, the singularity. I think around 2035, 2040 is when technology will be almost infinite, right? Because of the exponential curve.
And that singularity year is calculated by a man named Ray Kurzweil. Is that what you're...
Kurzweil, and there's a lot of others too who are agreeing with those. As we approach that, it's interesting. All the naysayers or all the silent people are now coming out and saying...
That is them.
They're looking at all these technology curves and like, holy shit, it's going to happen around that time, you know? And in hindsight, it was a simple thing to
guess.
To see. Yeah, to guess. Yeah. So... during that time, I think every disease will definitely be solved. Everything will be solved pretty much, you know, around 2035, 2040. So around that time, if you take that as a given, then you compare. So let's just say AI could be evil at that time, right? I think the chances of a human using dumb AI or near general intelligence AI will probably do much more damage than waiting for the AI to actually become sentient and have arms and legs, right? So I think the better question is, we got to watch out for our fellow brothers, you know, like, who's going to mess shit up before that, you know? That's a much scarier situation.
Is Russia going to get their hands on, you know, their grubby hands on the technology and do some damage rather.
Yeah.
They probably are with all this AI stuff.
All you need is a halfway smart AI to help you out, and you can do some serious damage to the world, right? Like, so, yeah, so people who are afraid of the machine itself, dude, I'm not. Yeah. I'm afraid of the people using the halfway machine. Yeah, yeah.
Great question. Hey, thank you so much, man. I appreciate all the, you know, the thoughts that you've shared today, and you know, all of the obviously the help that you've given me, and the encouragement that you've given me in the last 2 years and all of my life, and the inspiration that you continually bring to me as well as your community and the people that surround you. Thank you so much.
All right, thanks. Keep up the good podcast job.
All right, thanks, man.
All right. Yep.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.